You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And I think I'm going to say that for the rest of the summer.
Very likely, yes. Today is May 15th, 2024. We're recording this for broadcast on May 16, 2024. And today, Wednesday, is going to be the warmest day of the week. And I think the warmest day of the year so far, with a projected high of 91 degrees here in the Sacramento Valley, in our part of the Sacramento Valley. There was a lot of discussion at the National Weather Service sites and all the various Twitter meteorologists the other day about whether some part of the Sacramento Valley would hit 100 degrees today. They were looking at areas north, Red Bluff, Chico, Orland, as you go up Interstate 5, that they're going to be pretty still and warm up there and into the mid to upper 90s. 91 degrees for us. Low tonight, 54 degrees, and then we're going to cool off into some really balmy pre-summer temperatures, I'll call these. So the day of the show will be 83 degrees and sunny. Thursday night will be 53 degrees and clear. Friday will be 85 degrees and sunny. Friday night will be 54 degrees and clear. Saturday will be 82 degrees and sunny. Saturday night will be 52 degrees and mostly clear. Sunday, 81 degrees and sunny. Sunday night, 53. Monday, sunny, 83. You get the pattern here. It's all pretty much the same. Mid-80s during the day, mid-50s at night. Absolutely fantastic planting weather. If you haven't got your vegetable garden in or some flowers planted for the summer, don't fret. You're not late. There's plenty to choose from. More to the point, this is perfect. Perfect weather for planting those things. We've been telling you to hold off, wait on those melons and cucumbers and all that kind of thing. This is what we've been waiting for. Soil temperatures bumping up to where they need to be. Daytime highs, nice and warm, but not so hot and windy that you're having to water constantly. Check daily, water as needed, but wonderful planting weather for the next week. KDRT is community radio, and we usually go on a spiel about all that kind of stuff, but you know what? It's our fundraiser this week. So,
and last week, I asked for a help. Where did we get it? Listen to this. Help keep our community blooming. Support the Davis Garden Show. Do you hear that? It's the sweet sound of vegetables ripening, the happy hum of busy bees, and the rustle of leaves in a gentle breeze. It's the sound of a thriving garden. And the knowledge to cultivate that beauty might be right at your fingertips, thanks to your local public radio station's Davis Garden Show. But here's the thing. Keeping this vital resource growing strong needs your help. KDRT's annual fundraiser is underway, and we're counting on your support to keep our award-winning gardening show on the air. Well, I say award-winning. Maybe we haven't won an award yet, but we sure won a lot of listeners. Every week, the Davis Garden Show brings you the expertise of the local gardening guru, Don Shore, brings you landscaping tips for all skill levels and discussions on the latest trends in sustainable practices. It's a source of knowledge and inspiration for countless home gardeners in our community, empowering them to transform their backyards into vibrant oases. Imagine the disappointment if this essential resource went silent. No more tips on coaxing the perfect tomato from your vine. No more solutions to those pesky pest problems. And no more lively discussions on creating a beautiful haven in your space. Your contribution, no matter how small, will ensure this wealth of information continues to flourish. With your help, we can keep the Davis Garden Show blooming, offering practical advice and fostering a love for the natural world for generations to come, or as long as we're both around. Think of it as an investment in your community. A thriving garden isn't just about beautiful flowers or delicious vegetables. It's about creating a healthy ecosystem, attracting pollinators, and fostering a sense of connection to the earth. So, won't you help us cultivate a brighter future? Donate to KDRT's fundraiser today, and let's keep the Davis Garden Show growing strong. Remember, every seed we sow together blooms into a more vibrant community. Together, let's make sure our community's gardens keep blooming with your generous support.
Okay, and we also got, and I love this, a Shakespearean sonnet fundraiser appeal. We want to thank a listener to the Davis Garden Show for sending in this Shakespearean sonnet in support of our current fundraising drive. Hark, gardeners, a threat doth lurk unseen. A silence dread where knowledge once did bloom. The stations call a plea for verdant green, lest weeds of silence choke fair wisdom's room. No tips for blooms, no wars on crawling blight, no haven sung for creatures that take wing. A barren land where knowledge lost its light, a withering sound, no joyous songs to sing. Let bounty flow with every coin you send, and see the show of verdant life renew. For gardens thrive where knowledge finds a friend, and silence reigns where none their offerings strew. So act, dear friends, and let the garden grow, lest knowledge wilt, a victim of the snow. KDRT.org/donate. Thanks for your support. Thanks for your sonnet. Thanks for listening. Okay. Thank you very much to the listeners who helped us with that, John and Fair Oaks, for sending over those excellent submissions. I suspect you're going to be hearing those all over KDRT for the next few days. Got some new programming here at KDRT. There's a new classical music show, Classical Excursions, Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Classical radio programs often focus, says Greg Lautrail, our new programmer, on well-known light classics and ignore the challenging and imaginative masterworks from the rich repertoire of 20th century music, which is very diverse. This results in listeners who are unaware of many wonderful works. Classical Excursions will present shorter and longer works by famous as well as lesser-known composers with insightful commentary by a composer with years of experience in radio, classical marketing, and music education. Greg is a classical music composer, visual artist with years of experience. He's written ballet scores, symphonic works, band pieces, concertos, and chamber music, and also has worked as a radio host at different times in his life, beginning at the age of 16. World traveler, radio host, classical music expert Greg is now here at KDRT with Classical Excursions, Fridays, 11 to 1 p.m. Music programs are only online for 2 weeks after they are broadcast, but a podcast option is available. So check out Classical Excursions, Fridays at 11, KDRT.org to find the podcast link.
We also have some information here about the California Native Plant Society Garden Ramble. The seasonal native garden ramble is going to happen on Sunday, the 19th of May. And you can come drop in anytime between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m., rain or shine. And for information, you can go to their website, cnps.org. So I was reading the announcement that we got about this, and I came across this. Glenn Holstein, botanist, will be joining us again. He loves to talk about the new CNPS Yolokalusa chapter and conservation of native plants. He is a wildflower enthusiast. What struck me about that is he used to be on my firefighting crew. I was the crew leader for the Davis fire crew back in the 70s, and Glenn was one of the crew members. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, Glenn's a great guy, and he's very active in the local California Native Plant Society. If you're on this side of the valley, there is a new chapter. I joined immediately, Yolokalusa chapter of the California Native Plant Society. Patricia Carpenter here in Davis is an ambassador for the California Native Plant Society, and several times a year has what she calls a garden ramble out at her property west of town. For information on how to get there, go to cnps.org. It's easy to find. You're not going to get lost going out in the country. It's best if you can RSVP so that she knows roughly how many people are going to come. They've been collecting seeds of native plants to share. Mirade Mobile Plant Nursery will be joining them, and Glenn will be there to talk about the new chapter and conservation of native plants. Glenn is a wildflower enthusiast. If you're in the Davis area, by the way, you can see this garden easily. Just drive Russell Boulevard, head out as if you're going to Winters. You get about, I don't know, a mile or two outside of town on Russell. Look off to your left. You can't miss it. There's California wildflowers blooming on about 350 feet. All along the bike path there. They haven't been watered at all. They're living on natural rainfall. There are still plenty of blooms on them. So you don't even have to go to the garden ramble itself to enjoy Patricia's garden. But that's the late spring seasonal native garden ramble, Sunday, May 19th anytime between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m., rain or shine. Looks like it'll be shine this time. And if you want a map or more information, cnps.org, click on the events link.
So Don sometimes surprises me with things. And one of the things I like to do is ask him what's blooming in his house. But today he came in and he opened up this photo for me. And oh my gosh, it's amazing. It's a cactus with four blossoms all open at the same time. They're beautiful, peachy pink, variegated petals, the stamens and all that fluffy stuff in the middle is beautiful yellow. Just it's astonishing. And I ask again, Don, how big are these things?
Each blossom is about 6 inches in diameter. And these were spectacular. Here's the thing about cactus, and those of us who grow them and have grown up around them as I did, the bloom is very fleeting. It's got a lot of work to do in a very short period of time. It has to be spectacular. It has to kind of glow at night because cactus are mostly desert plants and they don't want to have those delicate little petals opening in the heat of midday out in the desert. So they open in the evening. They're open during the night in many species, and this one in particular. They're open in the morning all the way till about 11 or 12, and then they close up and that's it. And I was leaving yesterday. I'm not at work on Wednesday. I was leaving yesterday. These buds were just about to pop. I said, you guys better take a picture of this in the morning because I'm not going to see it. So if you grow cactus, you know that these unbelievably spectacular blooms, many of which are almost entirely at night, are a one-day thing. This cactus has been in our nursery yard for, I think, about 2 years in a container. It looks just like all the others over there in the planters, and it's got its own price on it, its own label, and all this kind of stuff, just sitting there looking for all the world like a cactus. And then all of a sudden they do this. And this is why people grow cactus. They're almost no input. They're incredibly easy to grow almost anywhere. Cactus in general are very, very cold tolerant. The only thing that's not good is soggy soil. So, you know, you put them in a fast draining soil and they sit there and they have interesting look, and the spines are sometimes kind of fascinating. But then all of a sudden they reward you out of the blue after a year or two in a pot with this spectacular bloom. I will make this the picture for the Davis Garden Show page at KTRT this week, because by the time this airs, they'll be gone. You won't even be able to stop by and see them. But every now and then, if you come into a garden center like ours in the morning, or if you have your own cactus collection, you walk out there and you're greeted by something like this, the stunning, stunning bloom of these types of cactus.
How frequently do these cactuses bloom? So this one, it bloomed now. When's it going to do it again?
The ones with these very big, showy flowers will tend to put on a few blooms over a period of a week or 2 weeks, and that's it for the year, and then they do it again next year and the year after. And they don't always do it every year. They sometimes skip a year. So you often, people who collect cactus do it because they're fascinating, the appearance is interesting, and then the blooms are just this amazing bonus. You're mostly looking at funny looking plants, or the fascinating spines, or the contorted growth habit, you know, whatever it is that made that particular cactus attractive to you. And then the blooms come along. Many of them bloom more but have smaller flowers. So if you start collecting, by the way, cactus are a great thing to collect. If you start collecting them, there are some that have little blooms that are very showy, that sort of spiral up to the center of the plant. They bloom over a very long period of time. The ones with big showy flowers, I'll make the generalization, bloom for a short period, a short interval, and then they come back and do it again next year and the year after. So it's worth, by the way, if you're a young person, buying cactus when you're young is a good investment. This is absolutely true, because their value increases as they age. This plant is worth quite a lot now and will increase in value. So as long as you're good at not killing cactus, which frankly, a pretty easy group to grow, they don't take much space. There's lots and lots of fascinating ones out there. Cactus collectors are an interesting crowd. They're fun folks to talk to. They have their own societies. There's one that meets at the Shepherd Garden Art Center in Sacramento. They trade. They know what the high value ones are. Just investing some of your allowance in cactus plants and keeping them healthy and growing them up into bigger pots is probably a safer investment than anything else I can think of right now. So invest in some cactus, young people. That's my advice to you today.
And if you like taking pictures.
Yeah.
This is gorgeous. You might not want to wait for 2 or 3 years before the cactus blooms. So we have a resource here in Davis called the UC Davis Arboretum. And there is, in fact, a desert section over there. And it's along one of the banks of the little channel of Pewter Creek that used to go through campus. And you can go out there with your camera and, you know, maybe something's blooming.
But you better be there first thing in the morning because that's when they're going to be open. That's the point. Right. I've told this story before, but my grandfather did drag me out of bed along with the other grandchildren, but I'm the one that remembers this, in the middle of the night because he had at his house in Pasadena a night blooming cereus, which is a night blooming cactus that he had trained as a two-story stucco building, Pasadena, classic Pasadena house. And they trained it all the way up the two stories, okay, and tied it up all the way up the wall, and it came into bloom. I don't even remember how many flowers it had, but he felt it was worth shaking us and getting us out of bed in the middle of the night to come out and look at this thing. And yes, it was. I was probably like 8 years old. It was stunning. It was in full bloom, all these blossoms open. They were fragrant. That particular one is fragrant. Some of them are. And of course, by morning, they were gone. And that was the other thing he wanted us to see, was that if he hadn't gotten us out of bed, we would never have seen it. So I suspect my siblings and cousins couldn't have cared less, but I was quite taken by it. So go ahead and drag those kids out of bed to show them the blooms in the middle of the night. At least one of them will probably remember it. Okay, lots to talk about today.
Okay, so Don sent me an article. I shouldn't say Don sent me. Sent us at the what's our email address, Don?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
And listeners, you can send in things to us too, whether it's your own brags or your own questions or a link to an article that you found particularly good or particularly bad.
Or garden-related Shakespearean sonnets. Those are fine too. I'll read them, I promise.
So this one was a link to something called Forest Farm Garden Ideas.
Yes.
And it is it looks like a little newsletter. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so it has that this thing titled is Plants for Pollinators, Hummingbirds. So they have a whole series on plants for pollinators. And this one is the hummingbird article. And that talks about, oh yeah, da, da. And then it has pictures of, Don, why don't you tell us what some of these things are? Just give us the names.
Well, I would, except I don't have it in front of me here. So
there
we go. Okay, there we go. Yeah, Forest Farm, by the way, is a company that's up in Southern Oregon. And I've been using their catalog as a reference for decades. Before the internet, they sent out this book that was their catalog, but it was an amazing resource. And Forest Farm focuses primarily on woody plants, or it did in the past, trees and shrubs and things like that. But they've broadened into herbaceous perennials and others. And what I thought was interesting about this, whenever you look at hummingbird plant lists, they tend to focus on certain plants with certain flower structures. And the point that Lois and I have tried to make over the years is that that's all fine, but they'll go to anything. I've seen hummingbirds going to flowers that I would never have thought they would be visiting. And
even
so,
that you think are too little.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah,
the whole thing about the trumpet flower shape and everything, yeah, is that hummingbirds can get into them.
Yes.
And hummingbirds can pollinate those where other things might not be able to pollinate them. This is good for the plant. But it doesn't mean that the hummingbird can't get anything that's not tubular. Of course they can. They hover in the air and they can just get to everything.
Well,
including daisies and everything else.
And a lot of tubular flowers have a nectar reward way down at the base, which presumably the hummingbird and sometimes butterflies and others that have a proboscis will find, and therefore they'll keep coming back to that species. Certainly, we know that there are flowers like columbine, which is the first one on their list because alphabetically it's Aquilegia, so there it is. You look at that flower, the structure of the flower, and there's this long tubular back part of the flower that they can poke their beak into, and there's a nectar reward down in there. And as they do so, they're inadvertently brushing on the pollen, which is exerted out in the front of the flower. Sure, those are designed for something like a hummingbird, but the other things that are on here are some flowers that you would not think of. Well, agastache, which is sometimes called hummingbird mint. All right, well, there's a good name. It's a tubular flower. But the next picture is a pomegranate. Okay, pomegranates are blooming right now. And they're actually beautiful flowers. There are ornamental pomegranates and there are fruiting pomegranates. And sure, it has a somewhat tubular structure, but it isn't really your classic hummingbird flower. And I don't think most people making a list of hummingbird flowers would immediately think of pomegranates. Well, I have pomegranates on my farm, and they do indeed visit them. And here's the main thing, they visit them repeatedly. So while they will explore any flower that I have, you'll see them going from one flower to the next. The ones they go back to, I think perhaps are the ones that belong on this list. And yes, pomegranates, which are drought tolerant, heat tolerant, beautiful, showy flowers, and of course have edible fruit, or if you don't want the fruit, there's ones that don't have fruit, are wonderful plants for the valley and any Mediterranean climate where it's hot and dry. They do very, very well. So that's an interesting one to find on a hummingbird list. Mahonia. Okay, we now call taxonomists have moved Mahonias into the Barberry group, Berberis.
It's Oregon grape, Don.
Oregon grape. Most people, I don't think Berberis is going to catch on real quickly with nurseries because Barberries are not popular and Mahonias are. So we're going to keep putting Mahonia on the label. But this is not a flower structure you would ever think of as particularly being attractive to hummingbirds. The big advantage of most of the Mahonias is they bloom midwinter. Particularly our native one, Mahonia aquifolium, but also the hybrids and the ones from Asia, Mahonia lumaria folia, is a spectacular bloom at the end of December here in the Sacramento Valley. There's not a whole lot out there blooming for hummingbirds at the end of December, so they definitely go to these, and I have to assume, since I see them going to them again and again, that they are getting something out of those flowers. Maybe they're eating bugs, who knows? Most people don't really think of them that way, but they certainly do that as well. Just quickly going through some of these other plants that might be familiar. Tacoma, which is sometimes called Cape Honeysuckle, or the Tacoma.
It's tubular, yeah.
Yeah, or Tacoma stands, which is a southwestern native. Yeah, and they're very easy to grow, very heat tolerant.
This one got me, silk tree.
That's I don't.
Thing. What?
I don't recommend silk tree at all. Albizia julibrissin. I love it. It's a beautiful tree, but it's in the list of trees Don has but doesn't recommend because it reseeds prolifically. It'll be all over your yard before you know it. I'm still taking out seedlings, and I cut down my albizia 20 years ago. But the flowers are open in the evening. They're fragrant. Most people don't know that. It's a legume. It's in the pea and bean family, but it's the puffball type of flower that they have. And they're very attractive to hummingbirds. So if you have one, and if you're in a place where that's not a problem, they're very attractive to hummingbirds. Please don't come down and try and order a silk tree from me. We'll have a long conversation about it. But if you happen to be in one of those places where it's an okay thing to have, cool. It's a great plant for hummingbirds. The next one is an obvious one. Nepophia, which is the red hot poker. Definitely, you know, you look at that flower, sure, the structure of that one is obvious. Heucheras, coral bells. I mean, yeah, they're a little tubular thing, and they definitely attract hummingbirds. And I've watched them go from one flower to the next. Campanula, that surprised me a little bit. Here's one that'll probably surprise you all a little bit. Asclepias, butterfly weed. First of all, stop putting the name weed in a common name. Okay, I don't want to put a sign out in my nursery that says, here, this plant is butterfly weed. I mean, a weed is something you don't want, so it doesn't belong in the common name. But Asclepias is milkweed. Everybody's growing those for monarch butterflies. They also attract hummingbirds. So that's a nice bonus of your Asclepias project. Ribes. So I think these last two will be the ones we'll finish with. Ribes, the ornamental currants. There are native ribes. There are non-native ribes. They all do very well here. Most prefer irrigation. Many, however, are tolerant of drought. As Lois has mentioned many times over the years, if you don't water them, they defoliate. That's their adaptation. They go to a summer dormancy if you don't water them. If you do water them, all right, they'll look better. So ribes are great. And the other one I'll mention is Arbutus marina. This is they're calling it strawberry tree. I don't like that name on it because that refers usually to Arbutus unido, which is a very messy, close relative. Yes, it's attractive to hummingbirds, but sets huge amounts of fruit. Marina has become a very, very popular ornamental evergreen tree for the Sacramento Valley and the coastal areas of California. It looks like our madrone, and it's related, but it's much, much easier to grow. Gets pretty big, but it's very prunable. And I have pictures of Arbutus marina in bloom every month of the year. Heavy bloom in the mid to late winter, but also blooming in the middle of the summer. And hummingbirds like that consistency. I gather they're rather obsessive little animals. They keep coming back to it. Those little tubular flowers are very attractive to them. So what I like about this list is it emphasizes the diversity of plants that do attract pollinators and particularly hummingbirds. And it isn't necessarily the things you're thinking of. Yeah, they've got salvia on here. They've got other things like, as Lois mentioned, spirea, weigelia is on here. But in particular, a lot of other flowers you wouldn't necessarily think of as attracting hummingbirds. I think the key to having hummingbirds in your garden is having something blooming all the time. It's forestfarm.com, and their official name of the business is Forest Farm at Pacifica. Lots of interesting plants, and their catalog, as I say, is an amazing resource on woody plants, broadening into herbaceous plants as well.
Well, let's look at what we've got in the mail. So Carlos writes, we live in Dixon. Oh, I should, let's start over again. Bye.
Okay.
Let's see what we've got in the mail. Now, this is from a week ago, May 8th, when we had that really strong wind.
Yeah.
So Carlos writes, we live in Dixon, and during the windstorm today, a beloved newly grown Texas mountain laurel pup we've been growing for a year in our backyard had one of its main branches snap and mostly detach from the main trunk in the same manner as an arborist might cut it off. Meaning to say, the split occurred straight down, leaving the remaining branch mostly intact along with the trunk. Devastated, I almost immediately started tending to my grief and give up all hope. But remembering the scenes from The Karate Kid where Mr. Miyagi repaired a broken limb on one of his bonsai trees, I set out to do this very thing and
Yeah.
began lovingly tying and bandaging the branch back on. I also applied Vaseline to the outside of the wound and then applied gauze and a bandage to keep the damaged area moist and protected from the elements. I also restaked the tree, and the damaged branch is now secured in a way that gives it an advantage to heal. I must have staked the tree incorrectly, so now it's wait and see. My question: what are the chances of this tree healing itself at this point? And he signs devastated in Dixon, but he also sent two pictures.
Yeah, those are great pictures. But first of all, this plant, Texas mountain laurel, used to go by the name Sophora secundiflora. Now it is Dermatophyllum secundiflorum. For those of you interested, just got to throw this out there at the start. It's highly poisonous, so don't, you know, if you're intrigued by this, look that up first. Beautiful flowers on it. Very interesting, extremely drought tolerant, heat tolerant plant from Texas, New Mexico, and northern Mexico, all the way south to southern parts of Mexico. And it has a leaf that sort of looks like a wisteria and a flower that looks a lot like a wisteria. So it's a beautiful plant, which interestingly, I've never been able to get at my nursery. People occasionally ask me for it. And after we go through the you do know this is poisonous kind of thing, I still don't have a source on it. So it's pretty cool that you found this plant and that you're growing it here. It should do very well here. Semi-hardwood grafting is done on many species, and the weather has been mild, so that's to your advantage. The issue with a graft or grafting or budding is whether the thing will heal together. That is to say, the cambium of the broken out part will heal back with the part that's still intact before it dries out. And that's the biggest issue, is that grafting and budding, there's all kinds of things done to try and seal it, to try and keep, you don't want to trap moisture in there, but you also don't want it open to the point that it dehydrates or desiccates before it has a chance to scar together. Plants do scar and heal just like we do. I mean, so they can graft. And I would say the chances at this time of year of that healing are pretty good because of the timing, because the weather is mild, it's not super hot, not super dry, but also not real cold. So your weather-wise and the stage of the plant growth is pretty good. I don't know whether this particular plant heals or grafts readily, so you'll find out. But from the picture, I can see one other thing. It did split right down the middle, but not all the way to the ground. And so even if this doesn't take, there's a pretty good chance, looking at the pictures, that a growth bud from below the point of injury will break and grow out and hopefully grow up and replace the broken top. I think you've done exactly the right thing here, which is to try and graft it and keep the plant healthy, because if it's going to grow from below that point, you still need those leaves photosynthesizing up there. Even if that side part of it dies off, I would leave whatever is intact and hope that it resprouts from below the point of injury, with a pretty good chance that it will do that, especially given the timing of this. If it had happened in the middle of August, I'd be a lot more concerned about it than the fact that it's happening now when the weather is milder. So you've done the right thing. Generally speaking, people use grafting tape, which looks a lot like masking tape. So it's not as intense a seal as what you've done. And the only concern I have is the Vaseline and all the stuff you've put on there might have trapped moisture in there on the graft, and you might get a rot, which will be really obvious when it happens, in which case you'll just have to prune everything out. That's a risk, but it's a risk that was probably worth taking under the circumstances. In the future, if you're grafting, you look around for grafting tape or sealing wax, which is what's usually used for these purposes. People come in during the fruit tree grafting season and want to know if I sell these things. I don't. You can buy them online, and so just do it that way. Typically, they will wrap the new graft union with the grafting tape, which looks like masking tape, and then seal over it with wax. But it's a very I don't know how to describe the density of the wax. It isn't a heavy seal, but it's carefully protecting it without just massively trapping moisture in there. In the future, that's probably what you would do, but I wouldn't go and undo what you've done. I would just watch it, monitor it, and the main thing you're hoping for is new growth coming up from below the point of the injury. That's your best long-term strategy here, is to try to keep the top alive, even though split, even though broken, until a new shoot can come out that's well attached and can replace the existing top.
Can you see on the picture whether or not that plant is grafted? I'm worried that it might be sprouting from below the graft if
No, they're
something.
not, they don't graft this. This was probably
They don't
cutting
have it.
grown,
Oh,
probably
that's okay.
grown, probably grown from a cutting or from seed. So that, I mean, that's a very valid concern with something like a fruit tree. If it splits down and the new shoot comes up, it's below the grafting, and well, now you have rootstock. This looks like just a cutting or seedling grown tree. So you're, even if it comes up from the ground, you still have the same plant. So that's the good news. That's what you're really hoping for, is a new, healthy, well-attached shoot to replace the top. But it is possible. It is possible. And given the timing, I think there's a pretty good chance. I hope you'll keep us apprised of what happens, that it will reheal and at least stay around long enough to support new growth that will come out and ultimately be stable enough for the tree.
Okay, so this next one actually didn't come in the mail. It came because Don shared it with me, and it was when he was talking with Fred Hoffman. It is tomato planting time right now, so I thought this would be an appropriate thing. This is Don talking on the radio. My son.
Well, hold on. The question was, let me give a preface here. Fred and I, Fred is Get Growing with Farmer Fred, and he's been on the radio since the 1970s or so. And once a year, I go on a show at the beginning of tomato season. We talk about tomato varieties and planting techniques and all this kind of thing. And I talk about the gopher zone. And I said I would plant mine below the gopher zone. And the question came in from a listener, said, I want to plant tomatoes without using gopher cages. Gopher cages are wire things you have to put in the ground. How deep should I plant to be below the gopher zone? And I'm in Petaluma, California. Oh yeah, gophers are a horrible problem over there. Thank you as always. That was a message to Fred, and Fred replied to me, well, this is your strategy. Care to expand on it?
Do you want to read what you said down, or do you want me to do that?
It went back to a big problem I had, and you can go ahead and give my reply, and then we'll talk about it briefly.
My son gave me a soil auger that goes on a portable drill. I think it's about 4 inches wide, and it can go down about 18 inches. The year he gave it to me, I'd planted 17 4-inch pots of tomatoes in my usual area and watched as gophers took them out. 11
11
of
took
them,
out
about 7 11 of
11 of them. Yes.
them. I had more plants growing in 1 gallon pots, so they were about 2 feet tall. I augered the holes as deep as I could, 18 inches, and dropped down the plants to the very bottom of these holes. Maybe 6 inches of the top was sticking out of the ground. It seemed rather extreme at the time, but these were desperate measures. Watered very deeply, of course, to hydrate that whole zone. Not a one of those was lost. In fact, the gophers, they're very territorial, so you're only dealing with one at a time. The gopher surfaced and created cleanout mounds 4 times around one of the plants, but didn't harm the plant. Since then, I drop all my tomato plants in holes that are roughly 18 inches deep. I figure the gopher zone is the top foot of soil. The soil auger is a great help. Your mileage may vary. Signed, Ron.
Yes, indeed. Your mileage may vary. I'm not promising this will work, but I was. This is an area where a gopher had moved through and just, wiped me out. 11 out of 17 plants taken out in a matter of 1 to 2 weeks, which is a demoralizing thing when it happens. It's not as bad as the 30 pepper plants in 30 days, but that was a couple of years prior. So I knew what the pattern was likely to be. So I had gradually started the process of growing my tomatoes by taking them from whatever pot I had started them in or bought them in or brought them home in, and moving up to 1 gallon container in the richest potting soil that we sell at our nursery. This is a great way to go. That means if you see a tomato plant in late March at your some hardware store or something, and you really want that variety, because you've listened to the Davis Garden Show, it's too early to put it in the ground, but it'll be really root bound by the time it is time to put it in the ground. You just transplant it right away. I have a table set up at the beginning of the spring, and as the plants come home, they immediately go into the 1 gallon can in our fancy potting soil. They flourish in that. They're in a sheltered location, it's warm, and by the time they go in the ground, they're at least 18 inches tall, typically 24 inches tall. I suppose I could say that I carefully strip off all the leaves before it goes into the ground, but you know what? I don't always. It depends on how much of a hurry I'm in. And that auger, if you have good soil, a soil auger is an amazing benefit because you can just go all the way down, not trying to dig a hole with a shovel necessarily, but just go, you know, it's a 4 to 6 inch wide hole, and you can go down 16 to 18 inches. And my experience has been, you know, as I say, your mileage may vary. My experience has been the gopher zone is the top foot of soil. Gophers, I wouldn't call them lazy. They take the path of least resistance is the best way to put it. I have observed, for example, after many years of fighting gophers, they'll follow a drip line. Why? Because you've softened the soil along that drip line by watering there and not the soil around it. So if you've put in a drip line for your vegetable garden, they start moving in, they take the path of least resistance. No, they're not lazy. It's just that that soil is easier for them to move through, but they're almost always within the top foot of soil. That's been my observation when I've excavated gopher runs, which I do sometimes just out of fury. It's been my observation overall that the damage occurs on young plants just put in their zone, typically. Now, they can come in and repeatedly attack a rose bush, for example, until it falls over and dies. They can do that on woody plants. But again, my experience has been a big established plant can sustain apparently a surprising amount of gopher damage without having a big problem. Once tomatoes are established, once their roots are down, you're watering deeply, I've rarely had any problem with them as they're growing. Shallower rooted plants like eggplant, peppers, beans, things like that, yeah, they come right up. They eat the roots off. It's gone. That's the end of it. In fact, the plant is often gone. You go out there and find the little bit of the top poking out of their hole, and that's it. That's very frustrating when it happens. But I began to realize that it's almost all the shallower rooted plants, the things I put in from 4 inch pots or ones they're particularly attracted to. So that's the first part of my gopher strategy is plant deeper if you can. You can't plant a pepper plant 18 inches down. They aren't that tall ever. So it doesn't work with them. Those need gopher cages, or in my case, they just go into large containers at this point. But things like a tomato, where you're growing it as a big plant, we're already telling you to put it in deeper. Dropping it down to 16 to 18 inches, if it's tall enough to do that, has worked very well for me. One other gopher strategy that I've adopted is that someone told me years ago they don't like members of the mint family. Okay, Labiata, Lamiaceae. And I thought, well, that seemed rather oddly anecdotal, but what the heck? They had wiped out those 30 pepper plants in 30 days, so I took that same bed and filled it with lavender. And I knew there were gopher runs in there because they had been all through there wiping out my peppers. They didn't touch any of the lavender plants. Well, that's interesting. So I tucked in a couple salvias, same family. They didn't touch them. I put in a nepeta nearby. They didn't touch that. This is a place where gophers routinely go through now to get to other parts of my property and do their damage. And they don't touch any of those. Let me rephrase that. They either are not eating them, or they're doing some root injury and it's not harming the plant. I don't know which, but whatever the case, so far, my observation, anecdotal, your mileage may vary, members of the mint family do not appear to attract them. So I planted rosemary, Tuscan blue, at the end of that bed. They didn't touch that. Everything in that garden bed is now in the family Lamiaceae, the mint family, and they leave them all alone. Nearby, they have wiped out plants that are, you know, within 5 feet of that bed. So my observation is that whoever told me that was right, that members of the mint family, or at least the ones we know, lavenders, salvias, tucrium, nepetas, rosmarinus, and all that kind of thing, they seem to leave them alone. So if you're, you know, getting frustrated and you don't mind sacrificing what was going to be a vegetable garden for something that's just going to be lavenders and things like that, that has been one workable solution for me. They did take out a rose bush in one part of my new rose garden by going to it and feeding on the roots repeatedly until it just toppled over, and I was disturbed and startled to see that they'd eaten off the entire root system. So I'm going to plant lavender there. That's my solution to that problem.
So, Don, combining thoughts about mint family things that the gophers don't get, and wouldn't it be nice to plant a bush for the beneficial insects? And what about some place where it's cover for the little birds? Are there any mint family shrubs that you can think of?
If I could take a picture of my Tuscan blue rosemary that I planted 20 years ago when the gophers wiped out those peppers, and I went ahead and planted the lavenders and rosemary and other things. Tuscan blue rosemary gets 4 to 5 feet tall. I only put in 3 or 4 of them. This planting area is now at least 15 feet across, 4 to 5 feet tall, blooms in the winter, solid cover to the point that weeds don't go through it at all, and very active with birds, especially in the winter time. Partly because it flowers in the winter, so that seems to attract certain birds. I did learn from someone years ago. Someone said, "Oh yeah, pine siskins like rosemary." Lois, do pine siskins like rosemary?
Pine siskins do, yeah. So do those little goldfinches.
Yeah. So you walk by this big stand of Tuscan blue rosemary and no weeds, lots of blooms in the middle of the winter, bees all over it when it's blooming, blooms at other times of year as well, but especially midwinter, and cover for birds. And of course, you know, where it happens to be, I see lizards running in there all the time as well. That particular rosemary is a big, vigorous plant. You need to know when you plant Tuscan blue or Spice Islands, there's a couple others. These are 4 to 6 foot tall, 4 to 6 foot across, okay, and very solid cover. So this is not something you put in a little container with a as a mixed herb planter collection, unless you want it to completely take over the planter. You put it at the edge of the garden. This is a shrub that goes in the landscape, and it is actually one of the most aromatic and one of the best flavored rosemaries as well. Tuscan blue has wonderful flavor for cooking, so it has the advantage of being a culinary herb as well. But that one in particular, I will mention, there's another one that I really like, and if you're in a smaller yard, this may be more appropriate for you. It's called Irene. It's got a couple of other names, Renzel's Irene. It's a very vivid blue flower, much like Tuscan blue. The flowers of rosemary are all shades of blue to violet. Some of them are just more striking than others. And Tuscan blue and Irene are both very showy blooms. And it gets about 2 feet by about 5 feet. Once established, it's a solid enough cover to keep weeds out, but it takes longer than the Tuscan blue does. However, it's probably more in scale with what most of the listeners have, which is a normal backyard. Tuscan blue is a great background plant. I highly recommend it. It's one of the best of the rosemaries as a garden plant that you also can use in cooking. But if you're limited for space, Irene would probably be a better choice.
We have a couple of questions hanging out there. Let's see if we can get through those today.
Thank you.
Do you have Jerusalem artichokes? How do you grow them? What are they?
They're a perennial sunflower. That's what they are. I've never actually sold Jerusalem artichokes. One of my growers suddenly had them on their list, which I thought was pretty funny. So what I tell people when they ask about Jerusalem artichoke, buy some at the grocery store. You'll find them in the specialty produce section. They'll be in a plastic bag because they don't sell a whole lot of them. So they're over there with the, I don't know, the kumquats and the other unusual produce. And it's just a rhizome, just like a canna lily. In fact, it looks very much like a canna lily. You can start it in a pot if you wish, or you can just stick it in the ground. Be aware, it will spread much like a canna lily in our climate. It will cover quite a territory. It has about a 4-inch classic sunflower flower on a plant that's perennial. I've seen yards where they're 6 or 7 feet across. You know, they've spread out that much and they're blooming in the mid to late summer. So it's an easy way to attract beneficials and hummingbirds and all that kind of thing. Then at the end of the season, you dig them up if you happen to like Jerusalem artichokes, and you wash off the rhizomes and you cook them. So it's very, very, very easy to grow. And it is just a perennial form of sunflower.
So if you're cooking the rhizome, that plant's not coming back the next year.
Not if you don't leave some of it. That's correct.
So you can divide it.
You can actually leave them in the ground. They don't have to be dug up here. In our climate, they are perfectly hardy. So you could actually leave them in the ground if you want them as a garden plant. You could dig up the part you want to harvest, leave the rest out there, and you can harvest for years. You only have to plant them once.
Okay. So here's a question. Can you get me that UC Verde buffalo grass? What is it?
Buffalo grass is a native grass, not to California, but to the American Southwest, which is had a lot of talk over the years as a good lawn alternative for low water areas, and it certainly is. It's extremely tough. It looks like Bermuda grass in its effect, a low growing, mat forming, ground hugging, rhizome forming, ground cover type of grass. And like Bermuda grass, it is brown in the winter. It goes dormant in November and it doesn't green up until mid-March or early April, depending on where you're listening. But it's dense, solid cover, crowds out weeds once it's fully established, and very easy to grow, and can live with 20% of the irrigation of regular turf. Okay, so and still look acceptable. It looks really lush if you give it 50% of the irrigation of regular lawns. So this is a plant that's always had potential. UC Verde is a UC introduction, University of California introduction from many years ago, that just greens up earlier. So it basically is dormant from, let's say, late November till the end of February, and then it greens up in March. So that's its advantage. And well, it was patented long ago. That patent is worn off, but it is not a plant that you grow from seed. It's grown, as with Bermuda grass, from stolons, from the stems. And you buy them either that way or more commonly as little rooted plants, and you plant them out like a normal ground cover. There's only one company that does this plant. It's not something you'll find at nurseries. No, you can't buy the seed, so I can't sell it to you. Having the plants isn't a real practical thing for retail nursery owners. So you go to UCverde.com. It's really easy. UCVERDE.com. And if you're looking for a tough summer lawn that looks good from March, mid-March, let's say April 1 through November, can take wear and tear, chokes out weeds reasonably well, and very, very drought tolerant, buffalo grass may be your thing. Bear in mind that as with hybrid Bermuda grass, you do have the issue of, you know, November through February, it's brown. Now, if it's uniformly brown, there's no weeds out there, that's all right. You could overseed it, I suppose, if you want to, or you could just have a brown lawn in the wintertime. If we could all get a little more tolerant of seasonal variations in the appearance of our turf, that would be a big step forward for Americans. If we could get to the notion that in the valley, lawns will be a little thin in the summer if you're using a conventional cool season grass and you just, you know, boost them up in the fall when the rainy season comes back, or you plant something where maybe it's brown in the winter. Are you out there in the winter? Is that when your kids are playing on the lawn? Or are you out there in the summer? I mean, well, if it's a summertime turf, then hybrid Bermuda grass, or better bet, UC Verde buffalo grass would be a good choice. I've had customers install it. They're very happy with it in general. The winter appearance isn't that big an issue. Again, they're not really out there at that time, and it's very, very drought tolerant. But as with Carapia, the lawn alternative that's out there, the way you get this is you directly contact these growers, they ship it to you at the right time, you have your area prepped, and you plant it. That's the labor-intensive part of it, because you're hand-planting these plants. It's like planting ground cover. You need a bunch of people who can work at ground level and get it all in the ground and water it in, water a lot for the first couple of weeks, and then gradually back off, and you'll find it's an amazingly tough cover. And one customer who sent me pictures years ago of the step-by-step process, planted in May to June, by late summer it had covered. So it's not that fast. It's not as fast as Bermuda grass or something, which is a rather more obnoxious turf. But it did cover within one season, and they were very happy with it. They found that it made a very, very attractive summer lawn, and then all the way into practically December.
So you say that it is very drought tolerant, can handle just 20%. What happens if it gets overwatered? If you water it like a normal lawn, does it get a disease and die?
No, it flourishes. It thinks it's in nirvana. This is native to the southwestern United States, where rain does happen in the summer. Not consistently, but when it does happen, it really happens. And if you traveled in Arizona, New Mexico in July, August, you know the monsoon rains can occur. I'm not aware of any disease or pest problems on buffalo grass. I'm sure there probably are somewhere it's more widely used. But it's a great alternative. Just you need to be aware of the, with every turf and every turf alternative, you need to be aware of the advantages and drawbacks. I just had a long conversation with a customer who had Carapia installed 2 years ago. They were really unhappy with it. And I've been getting this feedback. They don't like the appearance. They don't like the fact that its flowers turn brown and look unsightly. It spreads like crazy. They were not happy with it. I have talked to people, I would say a smaller percentage, who think it's a great ground cover, but not lawn alternative. So it kind of depends on how you use your lawn. If you like to go out there and throw the ball for the dog, buffalo grass would be great. You're not doing a lot of that throwing the ball for the dog in December, but you probably are in August, and that would be a time when the buffalo grass would be at its prime. Carapia, on the other hand, will be covered with bees at that time. So it's probably better for a big slope or an area where you're not necessarily going to be walking, but when it's in bloom, it's pretty. And yeah, you're encouraging not just European honeybees, but native bees as well. So each one of these has its advantages and drawbacks. As someone who's taken a lot of effort to formulate a blend of grass seed that works well here in the valley for a nice year-round turf, I can tell you it's a complicated decision-making process. I've come up with one that I think is really outstanding, and I've had a lot of people test it. I've tested it myself. But as with other predominantly cool season grasses, the August to early September appearance, the end of the hot season, you know, no matter how well you're watering, it can thin out, it can look a little rough. So there's no perfect turf. And you just want to figure out what your use patterns are. What are your most important criteria? If you're an older person, you just want to go out there and sit and enjoy the flowers and the bees and stuff, Carapia might be suitable. Buffalo grass might be fine, or you might prefer some kind of other ground cover entirely. Get away from lawn in your case. If you've got kids and dogs, it's a totally different conversation. I had someone recently who wanted to know about solarizing her lawn because she has Bermuda grass. And she had a three-year-old boy with her. And I've had this conversation with people with kids before. You know, Bermuda grass is a really perfectly acceptable lawn in many cases. And if you've got active usage, if you've got kids and dogs, there's hardly a turf that's more suitable than Bermuda grass. It's got drawbacks, many drawbacks. We could certainly talk about them. But if you've got a kid and you're going to be having the kid playing in the lawn for the next, let's say, 7 or 8 years, Maybe just live with the Bermuda grass for a while. Just overseed it with other grasses that look better for you in the wintertime. And let's not go through this whole solarization process and replace a lawn that would be perfectly acceptable. So before you put in a lawn, before you make a decision to kill out your lawn and put in something that's lower water, think about your actual use patterns. And also, this is probably most important, how many square feet do you actually use for games and kicking balls and throwing ball? Yeah, you need a pretty big area. Let's say 1,000 square feet, maybe 2,000 square feet. For a nice flat green area where you have a table out there, you go out and sit, and you need like 200 square feet. And you could considerably reduce your water bill by shrinking down the lawn to the use areas and putting in alternatives in the perimeter areas. And they can be flat growing things that are lower water, but just adjust them to your lifestyle.
So another question that came up is, a customer came in and thought that all the tomatoes were the same variety. That's because all the labels said tomato in a nice big font. And then underneath it, it had all the details about the, you know, what kind it was and how they did and all that. So to any listeners out there who think all tomatoes are the same, not true. Read the full print.
This is one of our we're very, 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 very busy the last few weekends when we finally have had good enough weather for people to plant tomatoes. So my favorite question subsequent to that one, which was, is this all the tomatoes you have? The moment she asked that question, we had 62 varieties of tomatoes in our nursery. 62.
So she hadn't read the label either.
I guess she hadn't found the one she was after or something like that. Any garden center right now is kind of at our absolute peak, and it's a little chaotic out there, to put it mildly, because, you know, we're getting our little tiny nursery, we're getting 8 deliveries this week.
Wow. It's
fairly typical. All right. And 3 of those are from companies that are bringing us vegetables and flowers and things like that. So someone will walk in and go, do you have Sun Gold? We kind of all look at each other, I think so. Let's go out there and see if we can find them together. There's a lot of varieties at your average garden center. Hopefully the garden center, like ours, has made an effort to get the ones that are suited to your region. Hardware stores still have a lot of them, although they'll tend to thin things out pretty quickly. As soon as we hit 90 degrees, you'll find a lot of the hardware chains to stop ordering vegetables, because as far as they're concerned, revenue-wise, the season is over. That leads people to think that the season is over, you know, for planting. No, from an economic standpoint for them it is, but garden centers will have good selection all the way through Memorial Day weekend. And this is probably the peak time in terms of finding the maximum number of varieties of tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and all those lovely summer vegetables. Yeah, 62 varieties. Is this all the tomatoes you have? Yes, it's all the tomatoes we have.
So the next question is one that just, it got me giggling. I said, are these good tomatoes? I want good tomatoes. And in my mind, I'm going, what? No, these are the naughty tomatoes. The ones that are gonna, no. A good tomato is a tomato that you grew and you eat.
When people ask this, I've learned after many years of doing this that they can mean different things. Is it a good yielding tomato? Okay, well, that's gonna typically be a hybrid. All right. For those of you that like heirloom tomatoes, good in terms of yield means hybrid tomatoes. They're more productive. They're more disease resistant. You mean good flavor? Well, then I need to know what you mean, because that's the flavor profile of a tomato ranges from mild and sweet to very acidic to a whole bunch that are in between. And my experience is most people want, as with most fruit, a balance of sweet and tart. They don't want all sweet. They don't want all tart. This goes for peaches, it goes for plums, you name it. They want that balance. They want the aroma. They want a bunch of different things that go into the flavor profile and the aroma profile of a fruit. And I do get some customers who only want low acid, as they call them, sweet tomatoes, in which case I'll steer them towards the yellow fruited ones. They tend to be milder flavor, tend to be sweeter, tend to have less acid in the flavor profile. And for some people who find they have trouble digesting tomatoes and they feel that that's the issue, all right, try Lemon Boy, try Golden Jubilee, and I actually personally really like orange and yellow tomatoes for salsa, so I can give you lots of information about them. Chef's Choice Orange is one of the greatest tomatoes that's come on the market in the last 5 to 10 years for productivity and flavor and yield. So that's a good one in that range. If you're telling me, oh, I mainly like to dry them, oh wow, then you should probably plant San Marzano or Principe Borghese, because those are dense, meaty, very flavorful tomatoes, probably stronger flavor than some people like, and they dry and become even more intensely flavored. If you want just a big old, you know, if good means a tomato for a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich, mm-hmm. You want a tomato you can slice, and the slice will hold together. All right, you want that
So not so many seeds. You got the
connect.
more meaty stuff.
You want what you really want is the connective tissue that holds it together as a single slice. There are tomatoes, let's say Brad Gates' yellow furry boar tomato, will just fall apart when you slice it. It's all juice. It's great for sauces, but Bodacious or tomatoes like that are firm enough. And actually, the Chef's Choice series—that's where this name comes from. They slice. You can cut them in wedges and put them in salad. They hold together. So you're looking for something primarily for its shape and form. Yes, of course, flavor is important, but you're looking for what has come to be called a beefsteak type, meaning sort of like a slice of meat. Okay, that's kind of where it comes from. Beefsteak has a long history and a long and is both a variety and a description, but what you're looking for is a sliceable tomato for BLTs, that kind of thing. But the big category recently, and in my opinion, one of the best categories for home gardeners, are these new sauce tomatoes, which are dense and meaty, not a lot of juice. So if you're making sauce, you don't have to cook off a lot of stuff. Some of the newer ones, like Rugby, which I've mentioned many times, is kind of surprised us a few years ago, is an outstanding producer and very good meaty texture. It's a sauce tomato, but it's big enough to slice. So you can slice that and put it on your sandwiches. So when they say, is this a good tomato? I want to ask, do you mean good flavor, good yield, or good for a particular purpose? And think about what you use them for. So, cherry tomatoes don't meet any of those criteria. They're just a snacking tomato, but they're one of our top-selling categories. And within that one, there's super tangy sweet, just sweet and mild, like yellow pear. To me, I have no use for it. It's a mild-flavored yellow tomato. Sun Gold has a much stronger but sweeter flavor, and most of the Sweet 100, Sweet Million crowd are more tangy, tart, like cherry tomatoes that people are familiar with. So we can talk about the flavor profile, but I guess our key question is, what do you mean by good? Any tomato from your backyard will be better than anything you buy in the grocery store. We know that. They're all good in that regard, and they're really good because you grew them. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
I'm Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Today, as we approach the 20th anniversary of the launch of KDRT and the 36th anniversary of Davis Media Access, we ask for financial support. It is a full circle moment, celebrating where we've been as a media center and growing towards the future. We put lots of love into making grassroots radio, and it is your generosity that helps us grow from seed to root to bloom and beyond. You can show your support by going to kdrt.org/donate. That's kdrt.org/donate. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.